Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Amanda. I am speaking with Amanda Satelli today, who is the author of an upcoming book. Amanda, tell us the title of your new book.
The working title is The Agility Advantage, but we're still working on the working title. So
still working on, but you will be talking about The Agility Advantage, which is, of course, why I wanted to interview you today for my book, which will be called Challenge the Ordinary. Amanda, I think if there's anybody in consulting who has helped her clients challenge the ordinary, it is you. With your long-standing career with McKinsey and then as the owner of your own company, you've certainly had many opportunities to do that. So to start us off, tell us how you came to the conclusion that agility was one of the things that your clients had to have in order to grow and succeed.
Well, many of our clients are very, very good at what they do. And to be good at what you do, you have to be very operationally effective. You need to have all the cylinders running all of the time. And you have to make the planes run on time and the packages be delivered on time and the store shelves stocked, all of those things. And it tends to create such a barrier to change in a way because you have to be so good at going straight in the same direction that you're going that it's very difficult to change. And in fact, you don't even have time to look around and see what's going on. Companies get in a bind. Their revenues may stop growing as fast as they were or even start falling. And they're like, what's going on? There's new competitors we didn't even know about. There's customers that are defecting. Whatever it is, they need to figure it out quickly and change, and they can't just change once. They need to keep changing. So I began to talk about this idea of agility 2 or 3 years ago. It really appealed to a lot of clients. They were really feeling like they needed to become more agile because they were seeing how companies like Facebook that didn't even exist a few years ago are suddenly very prominent in the marketplace and very large market capitalization. They see that things come and go much quicker than they used to. So they want to learn how to become more agile, and that's created an opportunity for us to work with them to figure out how to do that and to try to spread those best practices to other companies.
To use a metaphor, it sounds as though what you were seeing a lot was that your clients were really good at a 100-yard dash. They could sprint in a given direction really quickly, but the challenges occurred when they had to stop running in that direction and abruptly change directions. Would that be
an apt metaphor? Difficult because your whole organization is set up to keep going straight, right? And for instance, when you're listening for customer input, you're listening on the topics that you do well. So if you pride yourself on customer service in the stores, you're listening to how is our customer service going. But you may not be listening for the thing that really makes the difference in how customers choose where to buy, which could be the link between online and in-store experience, because that just hasn't been the focus prior to now. So it's a new skill that companies need to develop in order to be able to see opportunities and see the need for change and then to make quick decisions about what to do about it. And then after they've decided what to do, to take the first steps really quickly, go ahead and get going. And what I usually recommend is get going with an experiment. You don't have to completely revamp the whole company. Just try it in one small part of your company or try a little experiment because you have to start learning as soon as possible.
So you're linking the agility to learning, listening to what you haven't always listened to before. Have you been able to break this down for either your book or your clients to explain these are the things that you have to start doing that are different?
Well, one thing you need to do is be your own customer. So many companies spend so much time running their company that they can't really see what it's like from the customer's perspective. So one simple thing that I suggest is just buy your own product. A really funny example I read about recently was Mars and Company, which makes Mars bars and Three Musketeers and Snickers and M&Ms, also has a huge pet food business, one of the leading pet food businesses. And one of their PhDs said she has eaten every single pet food product that they make.
Well, that's one above and beyond.
You know, that's the kind of thing that you need to do. And you also need to stay very close to your customers on a daily basis to really see what's going on. So the same company, about half of the employees bring their pets to work at least a few times a week. And there's cats running around the office and things like that. So you need to immerse yourself in what the customer is experiencing, not only from your product point of view, but also from your competitors. It really astonishes me when I see companies who discourage employees from using competitive products, because that's essential to use competitive products. And make sure that you don't think to yourself, oh, this is my competitor's product, I bet it stinks, I'm going to look for what's wrong with it. Think about what you might love about it. Think of it as a new relationship. What do I love about this product? It'll really open your eyes to some new opportunities that you might have overlooked.
Well, that does keep people from getting too egotistical about their attachment to the product, doesn't it? Of
right.
saying they're actually doing this better than we are. This product is better in these respects than ours is.
Right. And, of course, it's not just the competitors that you know about. Most likely, when companies really run into trouble with revenue problems, it's often a disruptive technology that's coming from somewhere outside your industry. So you have to stay aware of those things as well.
So you're saying be close to your customer, understand their experience, live their experience by using their products, and then only then can you actually do an accurate comparison.
Yeah, we always compare this with more formal market research, but the essential thing is just to be in your market as much as possible. So don't stay in the executive suite. Get out there, work in the stores, work in the airports, spend time with your customers face to face, be the customer. That kind of experience expands the interface between your company and your customer that you're trying to serve.
And then what happens? I've put all of these data together. I've aggregated the market research. I've looked at things through my customer's eyes, and I've actually used my competitor's product. And so now I have some conclusions. What role does agility play in this stage of the game?
So what's important here is it's often very confusing at this point because you're getting a lot of mixed signals, mixed data, and you don't know what's important and what's not. The important thing at this point is creativity. So thinking about what your alternatives are. You're seeing a lot of stuff going on in the marketplace. You think some may be opportunities, others may be just distractions. And you need to decide what to do because, as you know, you can't do everything, right? You got to narrow it down to a few things and do them well. And so I think that the most important thing at this point is to get a diverse group together and think really creatively about what your strategic alternatives are. You need to challenge yourself with questions like, what would be the opposite of what we do now? Or how could we do it 3 times faster? How could we double our market share? So what would be some really dramatic changes that you could make? And then you may not go that far. These may be just thought starters, but then you think, oh, well, actually, there's an element of that that might work. So once you develop the alternatives, then it's time to evaluate those alternatives. And most companies have a reasonably systematic way of developing the evaluation criteria and sending teams off to say yay or nay on these opportunities. But one thing that I notice maybe isn't optimal in a lot of companies is they only attach one team to each opportunity, and that team often really wants to do it because it's in their division, it's their only growth opportunity, they want to work on cool stuff, so they are incented by their own personal drive and motivation to try to make this opportunity look really good. So they want the revenue projections to be attractive. They don't want to think as much about the risks as they might. And so what I often recommend is have 2 teams look at it, or even more. But if you have 2 teams, you can have 1 team say, why should we do this? And at the same time, recognize the risks. And the other team could look at, why shouldn't we do this? And that's just one way of doing it. You can also send 2 teams off to just evaluate it objectively and see if they come to the same conclusion. Because it's really easy to get biased when you're evaluating an opportunity. You want employees who are really excited about stuff. And so you want people who have that attitude of, I can make this work. So that's all good, completely good. But it also can send you down some scary paths that maybe you shouldn't go down.
So what you're saying is combat groupthink before it develops. So have a devil's advocate team and have a product advocate team, or challenge the team to do it within 1 team, but look at it from a lot of different angles.
Right.
You also mentioned diversity. Say a little bit more about that. You linked it to creativity of the diversity of the team that's looking at it. What kinds of diversity should be represented on the team?
Well, the minimum is just to get several different functions from your company involved. So make sure that you have sales and operations and customer service and finance and product management, those types of functions. So that's kind of the minimum. The other thing that I suggest is you have some staffers and some people from the front line. So people who are really working out there every day installing product or servicing the customer or whatever like that, and some people who are more thinkers back at headquarters. obviously, you should try to have a range of ages, because if you look at demographics these days and how culture is changing so fast, I've heard it said that even within two siblings in the same family, kids can have totally different life experiences because the technology changes so fast. One kid might be only 3 years older than the other one, but has a very different attitude about what to share online, for instance. It's really remarkable how different the mindset can be between ages. And as you know, as you get older, you kind of develop more judgment. But when you're young, you're maybe more open-minded about the direction things could go. So I really like to have a range of ages on the team. And then, of course, you want diversity in terms of what family backgrounds people came from and what part of the country or what part of the world they came from. I'm starting to make it sound like you need a huge team. You really don't want a huge team. You want probably five people on one of these teams that might evaluate an alternative. But you can get a lot of diversity even in a number of five just by picking people from a few different functions and getting the age and background diversity at the same time.
Do you find that diversity in the traditional sense of the word of race and ethnicity and gender is important, or are the things you talked about more important?
I think that the other things are a little bit more important. So I would much rather have one person from each function than to have all one function but different races and ages and backgrounds, right?
Yeah, it brings something else to the table that way. Can you give us some examples either from your own clients or from things we might have read about in the Wall Street Journal of companies that you have seen that really exemplify, they're like the exemplars and the avatars for agility?
Well, I really like Amazon. I actually spend a lot of money with Amazon, which is what drew it to my attention. But it's just such a well-run company. One of the things that I find most fascinating about it is that Jeff Bezos is very close to the customer. He's the sole founder and CEO of that company, and yet he still reads emails from customers every week. He'll be sitting in a meeting, and instead of listening to people talking about budgets or whatever, he will be reading emails from customers, and he definitely takes action when he sees a problem. He puts a team on it and gets it solved quickly. One of my favorite quotes from him is he said, "In the shower, other competitors think about how to get ahead of their competitors, but we think about how to invent something on behalf of the customer." They're very customer-focused as opposed to competitor-focused. And he also said, "We don't think of ourselves as conquerors. We think of ourselves more as explorers." So they're constantly thinking and watching. And as you know, they have excellent systems for data analysis, so they can see aggregated data about which products customers like more and how customers are responding to price. They change price very frequently to test different price points. They have this grassroots way of looking at customers by Jeff Bezos reading emails, and they also have a very sophisticated mass way of looking at customer sentiment by analyzing the data from their millions of transactions. So I would really put them in the camp of really being amazingly agile. And you can see by some of the products that they've added recently, which are entire new product lines outside of their traditional space, like renting space in huge data centers, for instance, to companies who need to do massive amounts of analysis, like NASA.
How would you compare and contrast Amazon and Apple under Steve Jobs?
The biggest difference is that Amazon runs on incredibly thin margins. In fact, is often not profitable. I don't know about often, but they have had a quarter recently where they were unprofitable. And even when they're profitable, their profitability is very razor thin. Apple, on the other hand, has really healthy margins and sells products at a premium and enjoys that extra margin on their product. So that's the biggest thing. But there are other differences as well. I think Amazon is a lot more listening to the customer. Apple actually, under Jobs, prided itself on not particularly listening to the customer. They did no market research, but they had a really clever, smart, highly motivated and creative team to come up with what they thought the customer would need in the future. And they based it mainly on their own preferences. So they said, "I would like to have something that could play music and access my entire library that's smaller than a matchbook." And they just did it because there was no point in asking customers about that. Same thing with the iPhone and the iPad. That's how they came up with it, out of their own creativity and their own insights about what they would want. Those are two really big differences between the companies. They're both excellent performers, of course.
Well, it sounds as though usually attention to the customer is going to be highly related to agility, and that most companies most of the time could improve by doing that. But the outlier of Apple shows that as long as you're creative, you don't have to be as much customer service as, say, Amazon has been.
It depends on what you're doing. Amazon is in more of a commodity market in a sense. You can buy the book that you buy from Amazon anywhere. You can buy the Makita drill that you buy from Amazon at several different places. So they have to be good in other ways. The product is not their differentiator. The experience is their differentiator. And price. Apple, a huge portion of their profits are from only a few products, so they can afford to invest a lot of innovation and mindshare into those few products. In fact, I think that the iPhone revenues are bigger just for that one product than the entire Microsoft is right now. The differences between the companies are partly driven by what business they're in.
Well, it sounds as though you're advocating that the company have a really clear picture of the driving force, because the driving force at Apple, of course, is technology. The driving force at Amazon is method of distribution. We go online and order things, and they end up at our front porch. So the agility comes after you've decided about your driving force. Is that right?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. To be agile, you really have to have a clear purpose, the problem that you're trying to solve for customers. When I used to work for Kimberly-Clark, we were engaged in the diaper wars with P&G, and everybody on our team, no matter what function they were with, was very focused on keeping the baby drier and increasing convenience for parents. We knew exactly what we were trying to do. So if you think about it from a military perspective, when you send a company into the battle to accomplish something, you need to have a very clear intent, because you don't know what the enemy is going to throw at you. You don't know what the weather is going to be. You don't know what the conditions are going to be. But you can say you need to take this hill, right? So I think if you can be very, very clear about the problem that you're trying to solve for customers, you can allow employees to improvise along the way and take advantage of new conditions that they encounter.
And what adjustments did you make with the diapers?
Oh, we made lots. We put the elastic around the waist. We put Velcro into the sides. All of these things are matter of fact now, but at the time, they were new things. So having the right shape to the diaper, having the right absorbency, having the right flow through the liner that touched the baby, having the little pictures on the front so that the parents could talk to the baby about the little ducks on the front of their diaper as they put the diaper on. All of those things were developed in that time period, and it was a really exciting time in that category.
Well, it sounds as though you also hit the nail on the head when you said comfort to the baby and convenience to the parents, because you made it more convenient to the parents, who, after all, were your buyers, weren't they?
Right, right.
Not the babies. Amanda, as you outlined your book and you looked at the chapters that you would include, how did you break it down of here are the essential things that I need to talk about in this book so that my reader walks away with a better understanding of exactly what they need to do?
Well, it's broken into three main sections. The first is about sensing the opportunity. So it's all about observation and getting a sense of what's going on in the marketplace so that you see new opportunities. The middle section is really about that decision-making process. So how do you come up with the ideas for strategic alternatives that you might want to consider? And then how do you just get moving, right? Just take the first steps, run an experiment, get moving in a new direction. And the third section is really about how to turn the ship in a big way and also how to stay agile while you're implementing. So this book is not about making one-time major course corrections as much as it is about having a continuous process of course correction. If you think back in the 80s, let's say, when quality was a really big buzzword in industry, the entire point was to decrease the variability in what you were doing. So work more and more to meet customer expectations in a very precise way and have very few failures. You still need to do that, but we've kind of learned how to do that, right? Now we need to learn how to adjust quickly. So how to be able to sense changes and make adjustments very quickly to allow the customer to experience new things.
Who should buy your book, Amanda?
There's a few different markets. One is executives in companies who feel that they need to get better organizationally about sensing change and responding to it quickly. Another is people in companies who are kind of in the strategy group or who are thinkers and might be facilitating and running processes to kind of organize all of the thinking that's coming in from the field and decide what to do with it. I think that a lot of consultants and outside providers will find it very useful. It's also just a good read. You know, I'm trying to put a lot of personal stories in there and client stories and stories about companies that are really pretty fascinating.
After somebody finishes your book, Amanda, what's the one thing, the one message, the one example, the one lesson that you hope the reader walks away with?
I think it's to spend as much mind share being ready for change and changing as you do on doing well what you do.
Well, that is an interesting distinction. It's not just about the change. It's about preparing for the change.
Mm-hmm. A constant readiness for change.
Readiness for change. I don't know that I've ever heard that expression before.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you're playing tennis, you want to stay poised and ready to go either direction. Your whole company needs to be like that. You need to be looking at where the ball is going to be coming from, and you need to be ready to move any direction. And that's a really different mindset than being highly efficient at continuing in the same direction. These companies still need to be good at doing what they're doing, obviously, but it's a new skill that you can add to your repertoire that's really going to make the difference between success and failure in the future.
So it's about staying on your toes, not resting on the balls of your feet, if we're looking at the tennis metaphor.
Yeah, I guess you would say so.
All right. Well, Amanda, thank you very much. You've done quite a bit to help us understand agility and the importance to growing and making our companies very successful.
It's been fun.
Thank you,
Amanda. Thank you, Linda. All right. Bye-bye.